Iran says Israel is fearful of the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal between Tehran and world powers because Tel Aviv's interest lies in regional instability. Anti-coup protesters again take the streets in several cities across Myanmar to march against deadly military crackdown. And also in the headlines, the number of people with COVID-19 in intensive care units in France's Paris region is at its highest since November. Greetings and a warm welcome to World News. Good to have you with us. Starting with our top story, Iran saying that Israel is worried about a possible revival of the 2015 nuclear deal between Tehran and world powers. Government spokesman Ali Rabi says Israel fears that the revival of the JCPOA would be counterproductive to its plots and interests in West Asia. Rabi underlined that the regime has done all it can to torpedo the multilateral agreement. He says Israel benefits massively from insecurity in the region and doesn't want peace. Tel Aviv has repeatedly expressed opposition to the Iran nuclear deal and has vowed to take any measure to hit Tehran's peaceful nuclear program. Last week, the regime said it was updating its plans for a possible strike on Iranian nuclear sites. This as the new U.S. administration has voiced willingness to rejoin the accord, which was unilaterally abandoned by its predecessor. Now, from Ontario, I'm joined by Robert Fantina, author and journalist. Good to have you with us, Robert. So, you tell us about the concerns on the part of the Tel Aviv regime regarding the return of the possible return of the U.S. to the Iran nuclear deal and the negotiations that could go on in further steps.
Certainly, the government of Benjamin Netanyahu would prefer not to see the JCPOA reinstated. This is for a variety of reasons. As you mentioned, Israel benefits from instability in the region. It enables it to perennially claim that its security is threatened and gain more military assistance and financial assistance from the United States. It wants that assistance to be a powerful force within the Middle East. Additionally, the JCPOA would benefit Iran, as it did for a couple of years until Trump withdrew from it, benefit economically, and that is something that Israel also doesn't want to see because it wants to be the only powerful country in the region. That Israel has opposed the JCPOA from the start was made clear when Benjamin Netanyahu actually spoke to the U.S. Congress, encouraging the members of Congress to vote against it back in 2015. They didn't pay attention to his pleas, and they did pass it at that time. Now, Biden, of course, has said or has indicated some willingness to rejoin. He's setting up many conditions for Iran to follow, so I don't know what's going to happen with that. But all these delays and the fact that it may not occur, the U.S. rejoining JCPOA, is all to Israel's advantage because it wants to maintain power. It wants more U.S. military arms so it can further repress the Palestinian people and steal more land and continue with its genocidal practices.
And Robert, also we had this report that Tel Aviv regime is claiming that it's updating plans for a possible strike against Iranian nuclear sites. How likely do you think that could be?
Unfortunately, with Benjamin Netanyahu in control there, it is very likely. This would light a powder keg in the Middle East because Iran is not an isolated nation. It has powerful allies who would come to its assistance should it be bombed by an enemy nation. I hope that cooler heads prevail in Israel, but I am not confident that they will.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments and insight. Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who joined me from Ontario with his contribution. Now, Russia is saying that Iran and the United States can take synchronized and simultaneous steps in order to revive the 2015 nuclear agreement. The Russian Foreign Ministry says that negotiations over who should take the first step could drag on forever. The former U.S. administration unilaterally left the multilateral accord in 2018, imposing the toughest ever sanctions on Iran. Tehran began scaling back its nuclear deal commitments 1 year after that withdrawal. It cited the failure of the European signatories to the deal to fulfill their pledge of ensuring Iran's dividends from the deal. The current U.S. administration says it will rejoin the deal once Iran returns to full compliance, Tehran saying that the U.S. must remove its sanctions first for Iran to roll back its remedial measures. Now, in other news, hundreds of health facilities across Yemen are on the brink of collapse due to the Saudi blockade and lack of fuel. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion is warning it can no longer store blood. Our correspondent, Sana, has more.
Thousands of cancer patients in Yemen are in dire need of help. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion and Research says the blood stocks and components of concentrated red cells, fresh frozen plasma, and the platelets cannot be reserved anymore due to the lack of fuel.
We have entered the dangerous stage of the collapse of health centers across the country. Our branches in Hodeidah and LBB have stopped their operations, and the rest of the branches are about to stop. There is no justification for this blockade. The interruptions in the import of fuel mean the death of patients with kidney failure and chronic diseases.
The center provides services to hundreds of kidney failure patients and cancer patients, including children with leukemia, who depend on the center to obtain the necessary substances to survive.
This center provides more than 60% of its services to people with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and wounded people. The fuel crisis is making an already bad situation worse amid the war and siege. Patients with kidney failure and leukemia need regular checks and doses of medicines, and stopping these services leads to the death of patients.
Yemenis are suffering from fuel shortage due to the continued detention of 14 petrol ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The fuel crisis is threatening the closure of over 1,500 health facilities around the country. International aid organizations and watchdogs have warned that the lives of millions of people in Yemen are in danger due to the all-out blockade imposed on the country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The international community has so far failed to take action and stop Riyadh from committing war crimes. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Antiku demonstrators have again hit the streets across Myanmar to protest the junta's deadly crackdown. The military used tear gas to disperse the protesters. No casualties were reported during the latest rallies. The junta took power on February the 1st, detaining de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other civilian officials. That ignited daily nationwide protests for more than a month. Protesters demand civilian rule and the release of Suu Kyi. The military, however, has unleashed a crackdown that has taken 60 lives so far, that according to an advocacy group. It says more than 1,800 people have also been detained. Well, we've talked to international lawyer Barry Grossman, and he says that there is no doubt that the United States is encouraging the protests in Myanmar following last month's coup d'etat there.
I have absolutely no doubt that the United States is involved at some level in encouraging these protests, and I think it's unfortunate all the way around because innocent people, including young people, are being killed in fairly significant numbers, and that's always a tragedy. And not to mention placards calling for U.S. intervention, calling for UN intervention, and so forth. These are all rather suspicious demands being made, ostensibly by ordinary individuals, but undoubtedly people who have been organized and at the very least are being manipulated by grander interests that are in play in the background. I fully concur. There are many indications that these protests are not exactly what they appear to be, that there's all manner of encouragement, support, and arguably organization and resources being provided to these people from abroad. And certainly from Atlantic world countries, primarily the United States.
Welcome to the News Review. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders says that his country has long ignored its childhood poverty rate, which remains highest among many other major economies. In a Twitter post, Sanders expressed hope that the American Rescue Plan proposed by the new U.S. administration could address the crisis and provide real help for children. That's not the first time Sanders has raised the alarm about the issue. During his presidential campaign in 2015, he had warned about a rising number of poverty among kids. Data released by the Center for American Progress says that nearly 11 million children are living in poverty. Recently, President Joe Biden has unveiled a pandemic aid package that allocates money to poverty alleviation programs. It also includes and expands a child tax credit that would mean new monthly payments to many parents. Now, let's get some insight and more information on this. So joining me will be a couple of guests, both from Washington, D.C. We'll have our own Colin Campbell there. And also we'll be joined by Wilmer Leon, who is a columnist and radio host and political scientist. Good to have you with us on the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Dr. Campbell first. Colin, 11 million kids living in poverty and misery in the U.S. Tell us more about the situation of these children.
Well, these children are obviously in a very destitute situation, and it really underscores the priorities that the country has, and based on a neoliberal model of just profiting for corporations, for companies. Many believe that we are living in a plutocracy rather than a democracy. And if you look at the way that the country treats its citizens, one would make that inference that we are not really a human-based type of governance, not looking at how we are treating our citizens, those who have the least of that of those. And so I think a lot of people are critical over the number of people that are growing beneath the poverty threshold, those who are very much in need, as we argue over stimulus checks that were almost not, that didn't come to fruition. And now, of course, the minimum wage in this country is something that did not make the latest stimulus bill. This is still going to be a big point of contention on the Hill between Democrats and Republicans. And again, it only shows where the priorities of the country are. If you look at just how citizens are living, if you look at the growing numbers of people living on Skid Row in California, people who have lost their homes across the country, you would think that our Congress would act a lot more immediately and a lot more decisively over raising the minimum wage, or at the very least, looking at various policies that could help the homeless, especially our children.
Okay. Now, let me ask Wilmer. Wilmer, tell us about the factors causing this child poverty in the states, and also how effective you believe this rescue plan can be.
Well, this has been a systemic problem in this country as long as this has been a country. When the focus of your economy is monopoly capitalism, when some of the ideologies that you subscribe to are things such as the Protestant work ethic and benefits for the individual at the expense of the collective, then when your focus is on individual gain and individual profit, then it becomes very, very difficult for you to take into account and for you to develop policies and programs that will benefit the entire society, as opposed to just the 1% or the elite in the country. And as Dr. Campbell mentioned about the Democrats, there were 10 Democrats in the Senate that voted against the minimum wage. 8 of them, as far as I know, are millionaires. And so the focus here in terms of their opposition to the minimum wage has to do not with its focus and benefit for the individual families that this will help to pull out of poverty, but it had to do with a very myopic perspective on the impact it's going to have on small business, ignoring the fact that putting more money in the pockets of poor people in this country is going to actually stimulate the economy, because those people will spend on some of the most basic needs instead of what people spent their money on with the tax break that they got out of the May so-called stimulus package. Mm-hmm. So Dr. King told us a long time ago that war is the enemy of the poor. He told us that in his Why I Oppose the War in Vietnam speech from Riverside Church in 1969. War is the enemy of the poor. The American defense budget is the enemy of the poor in this country.
I see. And do you expect any change, Wilmer, and also this change of focus that you talked about, I mean, focusing on individual interests rather than that of the community, do you think that will happen under this administration?
Oh, absolutely not, because Joe Biden has proven to be one of the strongest advocates for the war budget, and he's not articulating anything substantively that is going to have a systemic impact on the problem. All he's offering are platitudes and band-aids.
Thank you very much for your comments. We had Dr. Colin Campbell, our correspondent in Washington, D.C., and also Wilmer Leon, columnist and radio host and political scientist, who also joined us from D.C. with our comments and contribution. Let's take a look at France. The authorities there are saying the number of people with COVID-19 infections in intensive care units in the Paris region has reached its highest level since November. The head of ICUs in the capital and its surrounding area says that hospitals are nearing their saturation stage. Some hospitals have also been ordered to cancel 40% of their regular treatments to make space for critical COVID patients. Still, authorities have issued a new order to put the Paris region under lockdown. The region's health care warning that such a measure would be a last resort. France has tried to speed up the vaccination campaign, but remains dogged by high infection rates. The COVID cases in the country are nearing 4 million, the death toll now standing at close to 89,000. And in the meantime, Iran has reported 81 more COVID fatalities, raising the death toll to more than 60,800. Health Ministry is saying that more than 8,500 new infections were also registered on Thursday, and that brings the caseload to 1.7 million. More than 1.4 million people have also recovered from the deadly disease. Iran implemented a strict corona measures in November that resulted in a relative decline in the number of deaths and infections. But the figures have been ascending since new cases of the UK variant were detected in several parts of the country. The trial of prominent Nigerian Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zakzaki and his wife has resumed. During a court session in the northwestern Kaduna city, prosecutors presented witnesses and new evidence against Sheikh Zakzaki. However, the judge adjourned the hearing until March 31st to allow the prosecutors to close their case. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife have been in custody since December 2015. The two are being tried for charges including homicide and disruption of public peace, which they reject. The detention came after a Nigerian army attacked a religious ceremony in the city of Zaria, killing some 350 people. Since then, crackdown has continued on the sheikh's followers, leading to more killings and arrests. Now, the chairman of the London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Chajiris, says the trial of Sheikh Zakzaki in Nigeria is a mockery of justice.
This is not a court to implement justice. This is a court to delay justice and indeed make sure that justice is not implemented. It's almost 6 years since the incident, and no evidence has been presented even in the previous hearing. And it really is just so-called witnesses are being brought to go on contradicting themselves from previous court hearing, and it really is embarrassing. The fact of the matter is that him and his wife is being charged for conspiracy, and up to date, over the last 6 years, around 200 people were charged for these murders, so-called murders, and the authorities have failed to actually present any evidence, first of all, to prove these murders have taken place, and secondly, anybody was involved in it. And all those 200 and odd people have been freed because there's no evidence available. Now, at the 11th hour, Sheikh and his wife are being dragged for conspiracy to those murders, which already proven that there were no murders. It really is outrageous.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Welcome to the light. Japan is famous for its vending machines, but the technology is now being used to improve public access to coronavirus test kits. A group of medical experts in a clinic has set up 7 vending machines across the capital, Tokyo, to sell their test kits. Customers take the PCR test and then mail off their saliva sample for processing. Each machine holds 60 kits. The idea was met with great enthusiasm from people. It helps them to avoid crowded clinics.
Without PCR tests, we can't make a diagnosis. Early diagnosis and early treatment is a basic idea for all diseases. But unfortunately, there is no treatment for COVID-19. So I strongly felt that we had to do early diagnosis and early isolation.
Experts believe the number of PCR tests conducted in Japan is extremely low. They hope that the initiative can increase the figure. The machines sell the kits at around $40 each.
Teams of racing dog enthusiasts have converged on the Russian city of Irkutsk to participate in a 150-kilometer marathon on ice. The contest was held on the icy surface of the famous Baikal Lake. The racers, who started off at 5 p.m., had to put up tents and use warm equipment to withstand temperatures as low as minus 12 degrees Celsius to spend the night. Participants are free to choose their tactics throughout the race.
What's good about this race is its straightforward format. Now the racers start off and we will stop the clock when they arrive. Where they sleep and eat and how they cover the distance is a matter of their personal strategy and tactics. This is a contest for the real athletes.
The dogs can help their owners find the right direction in case they are lost on the frosty path. They can seek help from other rivals too. The Baikal race is an annual event that was held for the 7th consecutive time this year.
Get ready for a big dose of cuteness. In India, dozens of little turtles have been released into sea. Forest officials in a southern Indian town let loose 131 endangered turtle hatchlings. They had kept the eggs for over 50 days until the day came to set them free. The environmentalists also plan to release 4 other cute turtles, which are still too shy to come out of their cozy eggs. Marine turtles have existed for more than 100 million years. The numbers have fallen in the past few years due to human activities. Moving on, NASA's Mars rover, Perseverance, has successfully completed its first ever test drive on the red planet. The six-wheeled rover traveled more than 6 meters in 33 minutes. NASA officials called the mission a huge milestone. They also released images showing the robot's wheel tracks on the surface of the planet and surrounding landscape. NASA engineers say they are now preparing for the first flight of a helicopter drone carried by the rover. Perseverance was launched last summer and landed on Mars earlier in February. Its main goal is to search for traces of ancient microbial life there. It is going to collect soil and rock samples from the Martian surface and send them back to the Earth in the next decade for analysis.
An Australian conservation group says it will build the world's first ever platypus refuge facility.
We're also going to build a platypus refuge, one of its kinds around the world. This refuge will be able to take up to 65 platypuses in a time of crisis. Right now there is so much to learn about the platypus, and we know so little. These facilities will be critical in building our knowledge so that we don't let this iconic creature slip off the earth.
Platypuses are among Australia's most unique and elusive animals. They're normally found across the country's eastern seaboard. The strange-looking creatures are the only remaining representatives of their family. They spend most of their lifetime underwater and alone. Australian authorities say the planned refuge facility can give them more information about the animal's preferred environment and breeding. Many habits of the platypuses have remained a mystery to researchers. A family therapist in the U.S. state of California has come up with a brilliant idea to calm her angry clients, and that's a rage room. Yashika offers stressed people a smash session. The participants are allowed to destroy different items with a hammer, golf club, or baseball bat. They are required to wear protective gloves and face shields. During the session, the therapist also tries to teach the participants different ways to manage their stress in a healthy way.
So it's actually the first rage room to incorporate a therapeutic aspect. So when people come in, they're not just coming in to break stuff. They're really coming in to get the tools and techniques they need to manage stress and health in a healthy manner and a healthy way.
Yashika hopes the smash therapy will be largely accepted as a productive way to release tension. The idea was originally a simple stress reliever for everyday problems, but it was warmly received after everything started shutting down due to the pandemic. Hungry for music? You can now order a concert instead of a pizza if you live in the German city of Frankfurt. Members of Frankfurt's Philharmonic Orchestra have decided to help music lovers now that concert halls are closed due to the pandemic. They offer short personal concerts at people's staircases for free. Instead, Frankfurt residents can donate money to the musicians who say the main goal is to revive the creative industry.
We play miniature concerts in people's homes of about 10 minutes, and we deliver along a route in our neighborhood so that people can enjoy some live music. For us, it's just beautiful being able to play for people again. What's great and absurd about this concept at the same time is that we play in order to keep a distance. Yet we are so much closer than in a conventional concert hall, and that makes it so wonderful for us.
Those who ordered the concerts have called their experience delightful. They say the music delivery service has filled the void of the closure of theaters and music halls. The personal concerts can be booked online, performers observe health protocols and social distancing too. A rare black rhino calf becomes an internet celebrity as a video of her first wobbly steps has gone viral. The cute baby was born last week at Adubo Zoo in New South Wales, Australia. The newborn, yet to be named, has three siblings. Her mother is 18 years old and her father passed away a few months ago. Zookeepers watched the calf and her mother through cameras in order to create a proper atmosphere for them to make bond. The species is critically endangered because of poaching and habitat loss. Sophisticated scanning technology is revealing new secrets about Littlefoot. That's a well-preserved fossil of an early human forerunner dating back to nearly 3.7 million years ago.
Now, the importance of it is not only that it is the only complete skull of an Australopithecus from anywhere, but it is the only one with a complete skeleton as well. Furthermore, it is the oldest Australopithecus in southern Africa, dating to 3.67 million years ago. So it tells us a lot about our early ancestry. Now, we're not saying that Littlefoot represents a direct ancestor to modern humans, but certainly a relative, certainly a very close relative of our ancestors.
The fossil was found in South Africa in the 1990s. It's now being studied at a particle accelerator facility in Oxfordshire, Britain. The facility allows scientists to produce X-ray images of the fossil with extreme detail. They say the result has been fascinating.
The bone microstructure look amazing because we can really see the different tissues, the proportions, the thickness, and also the like the size of the different canals. So all of this make, I think for me, make Littlefoot more like a living person.
So far, scientists have found that Littlefoot stood on her feet. They know she had gorilla-like features such as powerful hands, which enabled her to climb trees. But she also had different traits compared to the human species believed to have first appeared 300,000 years ago. A Nigerian artist has become famous for his skills in creating art from coconut shells. Nathaniel Hodonu uses the shells to make stunning artworks in different forms, including portraits and sculptures, as well as home accessories. He collects shells from local oil factories, which throw them away as waste. He began his work in 2006 after his art teacher gave him two coconuts as a present. Hodonu now teaches art lovers creative ways to transform waste coconut shells into beautiful handicraft.
Tourism in Oman took a nosedive during the COVID-19 pandemic, sadly, much like many places in the world. But one village managed to turn its fortunes around by transforming some ancient homes into hotels and touristic attractions. Nestled in the high mountains of Oman, the village of Misfat al-Ibrahim offers some of the most beautiful and serene natural areas for trail running and rock climbing. Now the village has repurposed ancient mud brick homes into boutique hotels. The beige-colored homes with walls of handmade mud brick are elegant and simple, and the interior spaces are furnished with traditional wood and textiles.
Misfat al-Ibrahim attracts many tourists, so people and project owners in the village have planned on expanding touristic projects. You'll find heritage hotels, popular cafes and restaurants. We as a company decided to provide various adventure-related activities too.
The centuries-old homes were renovated for safety and comfort to combine old Omani life with modern amenities. The village is near what is called Oman's Grand Canyon and has somewhere around 800 residents. Many tourists have visited the area because of the heritage hotels and environmental components in the ancient village. These inns have attracted many tourists to the area despite the COVID-19 pandemic.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing The Land of the Enlightened, directed by Belgian photographer Pieter-Jan Dupuis. And joining me in this episode are Kalim Aftab, who is a film critic and freelance writer who writes for the independent newspaper primarily. And beside him, we are also joined by Jonathan Steele, who is a veteran foreign correspondent and author of widely acclaimed studies of international relations. He is also the author of Ghosts of Afghanistan, The Haunted Battleground. Now, this film captures Afghanistan's legacy of invasion, war, and conflict. The Land of the Enlightened is a docudrama that strives for a dreamlike reality to convey the fundamental divergence in worldviews between the US occupiers and the ethnic groups that have inhabited the region for millennia. Combining narrative and non-fiction techniques, the documentary's initial scenes present the first of many spectacular panoramas of Afghanistan's dramatic landscapes, while also following the operating base defended by US and Afghan soldiers who are attempting to neutralize Taliban advances on the periphery of the zone controlled by coalition forces. First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, I thought the documentary offered a great vantage point into the power vacuum of the war-torn country that is Afghanistan. And also, it focuses on a group of Afghan children who act as a gang and collect opium and other valuables and seem to trade them and live in parallel with the US soldiers. Kalim, if I could turn to you as our guest film critic, what's your take on this documentary?
Well, first off, I think the first impression is the cinematography is so luscious and beautiful. The director used to be a photographer, so it's no surprise he had an eye for that. And then what we find is this documentary that I found was very beautiful, and the kids were amazing. But there was some strange stuff going on. The voiceover was in a different voice that was presumably Nasser to the Nasser we see on screen. So it has this dreamlike quality where we're not quite sure what's going on as we're watching it, and it plays out as vignettes rather than as a very strong narrative.
That's some interesting points to make, and it's very arty, I suppose, the feel of the documentary. And Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what's your impression of this film?
Well, I agree. I mean, it's a very romantic film in terms of the use of landscape, the snow, the caravans, the camels, and these kids rushing around. But it is a little bit simplifying and not entirely accurate. When it ends, that trailer saying the Afghans are still waiting for their king, I think that's not true anymore. Mm-hmm. People now in a much more modern kind of society, half the country living in urban situations, they're not in these beautiful, remote, windswept landscapes anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's become a much more modern country than the film shows, I think.
Well, perhaps you could shed more light on the political context, actually, of this film. And Kalim, I'd like to ask you, actually, this film won an award at the Sundance Film Festival for cinematography, rather. And I suppose it's refreshing to see these landscapes and scenes when we always think of Afghanistan as a war-torn country.
I think it's refreshing. He's taken a lead from kind of Werner Herzog, who went to Iraq and showed these beautiful like oil fields up in flames and made them look beautiful. And here he's gone, he's used a 16mm camera, which we don't see so much film anymore. So already that kind of luscious quality, that kind of romantic quality is there. And then with his eye as a photographer, I think it's just no surprise that him and his DP created such a beautiful looking film.
Yeah, that's soft music when you talk about taking over a country without people knowing. Step one is you get the support of the locals. I'm going to trade them brass for scarves and whatnot. I figure that will stimulate their economy. They can melt it down and make IEDs out of it. Get rupees from the Pakistanis and brass from us. It'll be good. Good for everyone involved. Step number two, becoming king of Afghanistan, is once we pull out, I'm going to stay behind. I'm going to hide in a conspicuous vehicle, something nobody has around here, maybe a white Toyota Camry wagon. There's not too many of those rolling around here. I'm going to hide out for a little bit, and then I'm going to grow a beard out. And I might become supreme overlord of just a province, one province at a time. might migrate to Pakistan and cross the border a couple times. I don't know yet. But I definitely want to have an army of children because they frighten me. And I think they're like clowns. They scare people just because they're so innocent.
I get the impression from watching the U.S. soldiers that they seem to be living in a bubble there on the outpost, and seem to get the impression also that they don't really want to be there either. I see you nodding your head there, Jonathan. Did you get that impression?
Well, I
also
thought that was one of the best bits of the film, actually, the sort of pointlessness of the American occupation and what the hell they were doing. They didn't know themselves, and then this very naive speech that one of the officers gives to a group of Afghans who sit there completely silent. You know, you can try and read their minds, but they're saying, what is this man talking about? You know, who is he? What right has he got to be standing here? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that was really great. And then the firing, too, the Americans just blasting away at some hillside. Nobody else in sight. They couldn't see what the so-called enemy was supposed to be.
We have a clip of that, actually. We don't want to give too much away just yet. So
okay,
I won't
spoil the plot. But, you know, the pointlessness of the American occupation.
I suppose that's a symbolic message. And Kaleem, would you agree with that? What did you make of their contribution in this documentary and how they
portrayed? I really like the way that the director made a film about little groups, a little group of kids, and then the group of American soldiers, and the juxtaposition between the two of them. So in one scene, you're watching this pointlessness, and we bring a lot of baggage to the film of what we think should be happening. And he's just saying it's mindless. But he doesn't really hammer home that point. He's just show and tell. It's a good filmmaking film.
It's a beautiful film indeed. And I just want to move on briefly now to something in the beginning of the film. It's established very on that Afghanistan, through the narration, has been a war-torn country for a long time. It's been plagued and prone to invasion. Jonathan, if I can ask you, how accurate is this point that the documentary makes?
Well, in the modern times, of course, it's been a war since 1979 when the Soviet Union set its troops in there, and really that war has continued until today. But in the medieval period, as I point out, Genghis Khan came, and there was Nasrallah, the king, who was overthrown. But actually, a lot of the kids that we saw were probably the descendants of Genghis Khan, so they are the children of invaders. But this is a country that's at the crossroads of Central Asia, and so it's obviously one that many foreigners have tramped through and tried to conquer after Alexander the Great. The city of Kandahar, which we all know is named after Kandahar, is the corruption of Alexander. Mm-hmm. He founded that city. So there have always been foreigners coming through. But I think the point that ought to be made, and isn't made well enough in the film, is that the civil war is also there. It's not just a question of kind of united Afghans against the foreigner. There's a civil war going on, and really that's what the struggle is now about. There's the Afghan army with the Americans helping them, and then there's the Taliban on the other side, and even the terrible IS, has come into Afghanistan recently. Mm-hmm. And so it's partly foreigners coming in and partly Afghans fighting among themselves.
Mm-hmm. So it's an incredibly complex issue, Afghanistan, and you can't explain it all in one film. So I suppose, so watching this scene, I was worried that the children might be there in the mountains when they were shooting. But I would like to talk actually a bit more about the children now, since they're such a central part of this film. It seems really young to be dealing with this situation and the gravity of it all. And this film suggests that actually that there's a codependent relationship, I suppose, between the children and the U.S. soldiers, in that they are trading with the leftover ammunition, other equipment, and so forth. But then it makes you think, on the other hand, actually, they wouldn't be in the situation if there wasn't an invasion in the first place. Did this message resonate with you also?
I think what resonated more was the actual image of ammunition and how ammunition had become something that it wasn't meant to be. You see the soldiers just shooting into mindlessly, asking if it's an internet game, which is very true. But with the kids, they're bartering with the ammunition. They're also using it to weigh opium at one stage. It's become something that's so everyday, but it's not actually about the ammunition. It's not about the war. It's about this, as you say, codependency. And he shows that in a way without overbearing the point, which I like. But ammunition is a big key part of this film.
And also, Jonathan, I just want to get your views, actually. What do you make of this sort of fight for survival for these children and the way that they have to depend on these U.S. ammunition to get by?
Well, that's what made me feel I wasn't sure how realistic it was, really. I mean, these are, let's face it, child soldiers, and it's terrible that children are put in this position. We see nothing about their families, apart from one boy who wants to marry the girl next door, as it were, and has to ask the father, obviously, for permission. But apart from that, there's no sense of families or what the parents think about it. Do the parents want the kids to be doing? doing this? Are these orphans? Where are they living? I mean, so that's why I thought it was over-romantic, you know, seeing these sort of kids being grown-ups already earlier before that time.
Actually, I did some research, and according to the charity Save the Children, nearly a third of all children in Afghanistan are actually unable to attend school, leaving them potentially more vulnerable at risk of child labour and exploitation and so forth. And there's also the issue of early marriages and sort of obviously the drug problem, which is quite prominent in the film.
Well, there's also the unexploded ordnance, you know, so-called, you know, the landmines. There's unscrewing that scene. There's a scene where the boy unscrews a landmine to try and defuse it to take it off to be sold. I mean, and the other kids are sitting around within 4 feet of him. So if the thing does blow up, you know, several kids are going to get killed. I mean, there is a real danger. A lot of children are dying of unexploded ordnance, but more by accident than because they're trying to sell it. You know, they trip on it, they think it's a toy, they pick it up, it blows up in their face. So it is a serious problem.
Mm. So there is obviously a direct connection between sort of the US invasion and foreign intervention and the risk that these children have.
Well, some of these mines, I think, may be left over from the Soviet Union. They look more like Soviet mines to me, which are used by the Mujahideen and the Taliban as well, because they've got stocks of them. So it goes back before the US occupation to the Soviet occupation. Mm.
And did you want anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting, those scenes, because they're actually reenactments. So part of this film is documentary and part of it is reenactment. And I think those films jar, because those scenes really jar, because they are reenactments and we're watching little children act. Mm. And you can see them act sometimes. It doesn't feel as natural as some other bits of the movie.
Now we're just in the final part of the discussion about this film. And I just wanted to ask you, Kaleem, that some of the criticisms of this film is that it doesn't follow a classical narrative structure. But then perhaps one could argue that actually that this reflects a lot of reality because the war itself didn't have a narrative.
Yeah, I think the film has a lot of vignettes, as I said previously, and it shows the groups. And he wants it to have a documentary feel in terms of the structure, in terms of, oh, I've just managed to catch this by accident. But he falls down a little bit because he has reenactments, and that jars with that. And then also you see scenes like the helicopters flying, and it makes you think of narratives like Apocalypse Now and Platoon, and it takes you away from the documentary feel. So I think that, in a little way, which I really liked about it because it made it feel like a dream, but it moved it to a heightened reality. And I can see why that's a problem for a lot of people.
But perhaps, actually, I was just thinking it will draw in sort of political people and non-political also in sort of terms of a compromise. But just to talk about more about the politics of the situation, earlier on in the film, actually, it also talked about, it mentioned Obama reporting that there'd be 9,800 or so more troops that will remain after 2014, which is when combat operations formally ended. But then in late 2017, President Trump announced that he wanted to send an additional 3,000 troops to the country. I mean, what do you think the plan is for the US in Afghanistan?
Well, if I can just add to one point that was made earlier, I was talking about how the Soviet occupation preceded the Afghan, the American one. That clip we've just seen of the helicopters, the poem that was being said and being sung, was actually Russian. It comes from the Afghansi, as they were called, the Soviet troops in Afghanistan. So it was clever of the director to merge the two, although perhaps he should have explained it a bit more, that these people were actually singing in Russian.
So some subliminal messages there, perhaps.
More messages. We're coming on to what you said. Yes, there are now today 14,000 American troops in Afghanistan, and Obama had hoped to bring them out all scale by the time he packed up as president a year and a bit ago. So it's an open-ended war. It's a quagmire. It's a pit, you know, in which they've fallen and they can't get out of. But the worst thing is really the Afghan troops. I said it was a civil war. The Afghan troops are also fighting. It's not just the Americans. They're losing something like 20 soldiers a day, more than 8,000 a year. If you think that the Americans themselves only lost 2,400 in 15 years, and the Afghans are losing 8,000 a year, the rate of attrition is colossal, which is why there's massive desertion. People don't sign up again, and they try and avoid being conscripted, and it's a terrible, terrible situation.
And terrible indeed. I wish we could talk more, actually, because there's just so much to talk about. But actually, I just wanted to get your final thoughts on the film now. Kaleem, what's your final thoughts on this documentary, and would you recommend it?
I would definitely recommend it, but I would recommend it for kind of the romanticism and poeticness of it, and that is very different to other documentaries on the subject, for its uniqueness, rather than perhaps its political message.
And Jonathan, your final thoughts on
that? Well, I would agree with that. I think it's a sort of good introduction, you know, get in there. It points to some complex issues in a simplistic way, but it's because it's so romantically filmed and brilliantly filmed, it should get people more interested to learn more.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests again. And for you, I've been Camilla Shambayati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.